of all hams that are interested in electronics and radio. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and K2 Kilowatt Echo Yankee, his name is Mel, and Dick and Mel try to gather the clan and make things a little bit more fun with reference to ham radio, make things a little bit more understandable. The radio art and science, the wireless technology, it's got a whole lot of characteristics that are not easy to understand. The books give you some of the information. The classes give you a little bit of the information. Even a college course in electrical engineering with a specialization in communications tells you about 5 or 10% of what you need to know to work well in that industry. It takes an apprenticeship. One of the best apprenticeships in the world is called ham radio. If you tinker with antennas in the backyard and transmitters and oscillators and phase lock loops and whatever in the basement and so on, you're learning that art. And as I said, the classes that I'm aware of only do a partial job of it. If you really want somebody who understands radio and antennas and propagation and receivers, you hire a ham radio operator. Ham radio operators are very good at communicating. They teach each other. It's not their main motivation. That's something that happens. That's something that happens directly. It happens indirectly. This TechNet claims to be one of the areas where some of that is helped along. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, because I'm so darn forgetful. Try to remember to give me your name. And then you follow that with the word yes or no. And the word yes means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Either some of the previous assignments you received, the homework assignments, reporting on what you tried, what worked, what didn't try, what didn't work, or what you would like to ask us questions about tonight. Those are the kinds of yeses. So you need not sign in if you are just letting us know you're there. After 27 years, it will be in this coming September, we assume that people are there. This is TechNet number 1251 of the series that began in 1982. By now,
repeater, timeout.
By now, we assume that I'm verbose and people are there. So, if you've got a question or a comment, please sign in, give us your yes. Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW listening.
N2EO, Dick, yes.
B2OIY, Joe, yes.
WS2N, Paul. I would have known.
And KGOC Howard, no.
W2, Victor David Henry,
John, no.
N2, NNU, no.
Delta, John, no.
KC2, NNU, no.
See you all, K2, KEY.
Okay, we've heard from Rich, Joe, Paul, John, Alex, and the yeses so far are Rich, Joe, and those are the only yeses so far. Are there any other yeses? Give me your call letters right now. Okay, one last call. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet, particularly with a yes? Give me your call letters right now.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. This is K2KEY.
This guy who didn't give us his name. He's already been announced. Glad to hear from you, Mel. Sorry I didn't get a chance to see you guys over the field day. And field day is one of the things that we will be discussing tonight after we answer people's questions first. First person with a real question was Rich, one of our frequent signers, N2EO. What's happening in Whitestone, Rich? K2RIW.
Good evening, Dick. N2EO with the TechNet. Dick, I've been experimenting here over the last, a year on cleaning up some of these boat anchors like the KWM2 and the 75S3. I think Mel will find this of interest. Some of the people I know in the Collins Radio Association and the Collins Collectors Association use non-sensing ammonia mixed with things like 409 or something called Simple Green that I believe they get in Home Depot. And usually what most people do and what I was doing was you go over the chassis with a paintbrush with a chemical like that and a toothbrush, scrub it down, and then rinse it off. Recently, I was on a website for Drake equipment, and a guy who runs the website said that he takes Drake TR4s, R4Bs, radios like that, and puts them in the dishwasher. So I contacted him, and we emailed back and forth a few times, and he said to me he's never lost a radio in a number of years doing this. So, on Friday, I took a Junker KWM-2A, one that I've been picking parts out of, strictly a parts radio, and I put it in the dishwasher. I was amazed how clean it came out. I dissected two of the coils in the IF to see if there was any damage to them. There was no damage. So today, I put both a 75S3P, a working radio, and a KWM-2 in the dishwasher, and you'd be amazed. It took off the oxidation on the chassis shine. Everything came out shiny, clean, about as close to new as you're going to get out of the Collins factory. And it would probably work with most any other boat anchor. I used Cascade dishwashing powder and just ran it through a normal cycle. But I am going to let these radios sit and dry for a good week, maybe even more than a week. And then what I'm going to do is bring them up very slowly on a variac, low voltage, bring up the voltage very slowly on a variac, and lightly fuse them with like a quarter amp or a half amp fuse. So that's what I wanted to, information I want to offer, Dick. I took some before and after pictures because I'm going to be publishing an article in the Weimark Log on radio restoration. So we're adding this to the article. Back to Ned and to Leo.
Okay, to a J with a comment. Yeah, go ahead, Eric. I'm amazed by this. I've got some comments. You got it, Eric.
Yeah, Rich, if you don't want anything to oxidize, especially if you put your transformer through it, really the best thing to do is put it in a 110 to 120 degree oven for about 6 hours and force the water out of things. If you're going to let it dry for a long period of time, you may, in fact, have some problems that you don't want. That's my comment. Back to that. Keep the RW, KE2J.
Now, putting your radio in a dishwasher, and the dishwasher powder, the soap suds, so to speak, that you put in there, is pretty strong stuff. And the fact that it can clean up the radio, that's a given. There's two things that I worry about. Number one, similar to what Eric is talking about, water getting into the individual layers of insulation of the transformer, and some transformers have got a nice outer cover, so water can be forced in there, and it'll be very difficult for it to find ways to get back out again. And the first water that's forced in there has got all the strong chemicals, and a little bit of water comes in later on during the rinse cycle, doesn't get a chance to really rinse out those chemicals. So I'm worried about that. IF cans also, I'm worried about substances get in there that take a long time to get out. The second thing I'm worried about is that my particular dishwasher, and many of them, and the drying cycle, the very last cycle, go up to some extremely high temperatures. If someone told me it goes up to 250 degrees Fahrenheit, I'd believe it, just to make sure it boils off all the water. And so some IF transformers and tunable slugs and whatever have a wax-like substance that holds the slug in the right place. And I fear that the high temperature will melt out that wax.
You can usually turn that off.
Yeah, Dick.
Most dishwashers, so you don't go through a dry cycle.
Okay, so I guess you did turn off the high temperature cycle at the end. Is that what you're saying, Rich?
That's correct, Dick. It goes through, you can have it either a long cycle or a short cycle. I put it through the short cycle, and as soon as it went into that cycle, I cut it off, so it never saw the heat.
Okay, well done. Let me let it drop. Then the next suggestion of Eric sounds like an extremely good one, and that is to put it at, I'll pick a number, 145 degrees Fahrenheit on an oven and let it bake.
Too hot, not hotter than 120.
Okay, 120. So 120 degrees for roughly how many hours do you recommend, Eric, and where did that number come from?
Well, from actually personal experience, other people have written about it, anywhere from 6 to 8 hours is usually pretty good. You can tell when most transformer covers and stuff like that, you stick a Q-tip in there, you'll find it's sometimes it's a little damp, you want to leave it in a little longer. There's places where water will accumulate, and even though you bring it up to 120 degrees, it's still evaporating, but it'll condense against the metal, so you got to watch it.
Have you used the dishwasher tuning, cleaning technique, Eric, or have you ever heard of it, about it before Rich brought it to our attention? KE2EJ, K2LAW?
Now, you know, a lot of that stuff is like 20-year-old stuff that I have at 21, and they've been through the dishwasher. I tend not to like to use Cascade, but one of the things that you can do is take whatever detergent, I have a detergent that I like to use because it's just made for electronic components. There is a way to do a sample. You take whatever the detergent you want to use is. You take a piece of felt, okay, soak it in the detergent, kind of approximating the way it's diluted in the dishwasher, rinse it out, dry it up, put it on me to crush it.
Okay, and I guess you're worried about whether or not the material leaves a conductive residue. Now, Eric, Rich is recommending this as a method of taking older equipment, boat anchors as he called them, World War II and a little bit after type stuff, which has a lot of oxidation, a lot of grime and whatever, and I can see how the rather strong substances used in a dishwasher and the fairly rigorous spraying cycles can do a very good job of cleaning that all up. Let me jump one step ahead. You've got some extremely expensive cameras, probably $50,000 worth of charge-coupled device, high-definition camera. If someone recommended you take that camera and put it in a dishwasher, would your hand shake a little bit as you turn that thing on, KE2EJ, K2LAW?
Well, let me tell you a little story. I have an HL55. It's a very old camera. What you do is you take the optics block out, you take the lens fitting out, and you pull all the boards out, you wash the boards in the dishwasher. There's usually no reason to wash a motherboard, but you can, okay? But yeah, I wouldn't actually take the camera. I'd take the pieces of the camera, the PC boards, things that you know are okay, they're saturated with water, that when you boys dry them, they're fine. But, you ain't putting the shell of the camera, because a lot of padding and felt and other materials that come in contact with water, you know it's going to fall apart, especially in a dishwasher environment. So, the other thing you got to watch out for is like when you're doing really old stuff, paper capacitors, you know, you don't realize it, but most dishwashers have hot water. And, you know, the hot water's not coming out at 212 degrees. It's you know, scalding. Most people don't run their hot water, you know, say, past 140, 150, but that's really hot. But that's warm enough to melt the wax on the caps, and you can get water in there, you ain't never going to get out, so you got to watch it.
Yeah, no paper caps. Collins used some of those black capacitors, what they refer to as black beauties, and they've been changed to more contemporary sprig orange drop mylars, or what do you call them, plastic capacitors.
Yeah, and another thing I'm sure you would never want to put in the dishwasher is a zoom lens. If water got in between the individual elements of a lens, I think getting it out of there without leaving a residue, because there the word residue has got an extremely different meaning. I mean, a few molecules of something laying on the surface of a lens, it's going to leave a smudge, so...
Now, let me give you another story.
Go right ahead.
It occasionally happens. Well, some of the people that I know, they own this big truck company. They go out and do, the U.S. Open and stuff like that. And on occasion, a Canon lens, you know, a $35,000-$40,000 lens falls in the drink. And believe it or not, because it's a professional lens, you send it back to the manufacturer and they take it all apart and they ultrasonically clean the metal. Oh, that's gorgeous. And they lubricate the thing up, and when it comes back to you, it's as good as new, but you also got a nice repair bill to pay for afterwards.
Okay, so I think we're slowly concluding that certain items, paper capacitors, the drying cycle with all of its heat, lenses, things where water can get in, get trapped. I'm a little worried about water getting trapped inside of an IF can or inside of a transformer that's got metal shields around the outside. But by way of the 100-degree, 68-hour baking process...
Yeah, it avoids oxidation.
Yeah, you don't want the water sitting in there for a long period of time. That's why you want to bake it out. And even though the water is going to run at a higher temperature, and whatever rusting it's doing is going to be speeding up, still, to get it out of there in a hurry, I think, is the main thing you want to do before all of its electrolysis-like process takes place. I think rusting is somewhat of an electrolysis-like process, obvious by the fact that galvanizing on top of steel will stop rusting because the galvanizing sacrifices itself to the place on the steel where rust would have formed. So, interesting concept. You've done it now on two units, and you're about to inspect them after the drying process, I guess, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, yes, I did it this afternoon on a KWM-2A and a 75S-3B receiver. This is vintage 1960-1970 tube equipment. I definitely would not recommend this on a more modern Japanese radio. They use a lot of plastics. They use a lot of double-stick tape, foam rubber. I would not do it on one of those. This is a basic type of piece of equipment. And I can tell you, it cleaned up the chassis had light oxidation, graying, and it came out bright and shiny. It's amazing. Now, I guess that the proof of the pudding will be in about a week when I fire everything up. I will take your advice and bake it for 6 to 8 hours around. I've done baking on, leave a pause there. I've done baking on cabinets that I've painted. What I generally do is put the oven on the minimum temperature, around 100 degrees, pop it in there and leave the door on the oven open. This is something I read years ago. I don't know if it was QST or where I read it, but that was the recommended procedure. So I could do that. That's not a problem, but still I feel much safer. I'm very patient when it comes to... You got to be patient on these restorations. You can't rush it. So I probably won't fire this thing up until next Sunday or Monday. And we'll let you know how we make out, Dick, and Tulio.
Oh, by the way, the other thing that force drying it prevents mold from happening. If you're doing mil-spec stuff, it's got the antifungal coating on it, and you're actually not cleaning it, you're cleaning the coating. But if you just let it dry on its own and there's any kind of moisture around it, you start getting mold growth. Dick?
Interesting. Rich, do you leave the tubes plugged in while you're doing this cleaning procedure, or do you locate the tubes as separate items? I see some advantage in unplugging the tubes so that the cleaning process can get down into the context of the socket. Over to you, Rich, on that one.
Yeah, I took all the hardware off, the knobs, took the S-meter out, the tubes came out, the tube shields came out. Definitely take the meter out because that's a no-no, get water in a meter.
Yeah, I never even thought of that one. Wow. And by the way, whenever people talk about changing the scale on a meter, that is an extremely delicate operation. You open up a Dawson valve movement. That horseshoe magnet that's in there is the strongest thing in the world. and if there is a piece of steel wool that was used in your house 3 years ago, and it's 15 feet away, it'll find some way of getting onto your bench and getting sucked into that mechanism, and you'll have a sticking meter, and getting chunks of steel wool out of the magnet of a Dawson valve movement, an S-meter, very, very difficult. Okay, so some of the delicate items you remove, you obviously left in the IF cans, and I guess you didn't worry about those. Fascinating. Sounds severe, but I can see how it'll make them look clean. Now let's hope it all survives. With the right kind of a care, I guess you can make it survive. And we'll hear about that next week. Good show. That's a new one. Okay, Rich, Joe, W-A-2-R-Y-Y. What's happening in your neighborhood? K-2-R-I-W.
I hear something identifying in the background. I don't know if it's a repeater or what that is. I guess it is. Okay, I have a question on a degaussing coil. I purchased one about a month or so ago. Used it on a particular monitor that had a problem with the closed wart rhino thing, and it straightened it out, but that's not my problem with the question. The thing arcs when I turn the switch off. You can actually hear the electrical arc of the switch disconnecting. You can hear the arc going across the switch. Now, do you need the information about the degaussing coil itself? Because what I'm asking as far as the question is, what would you suggest that I use to minimize that arcing across the switch?
Now, give us a couple of words on this degaussing coil. I've seen the kind that you wave in front of a cathode ray tube, and it's a great big large diameter multi-turn air coil. I've seen other kinds of degaussing coils, which are sort of an open frame transformer used for wiping out magnetic tapes and things like that. So give us a few descriptions of the degaussing coil. Brand name, size, what does it look like, and so on. And so I guess you're saying you hear the arcing when you turn off its on-off switch, and you think that that's eventually damaging and you want to do something about it, if I understand. But let me hear a little bit more about what is the item itself. Back to you, Joe.
Okay, the item is a 14-inch, approximately 14-inch diameter coil of many turns of wire. I don't know the precise gauge of the wire, but the wire measures about 0.30 diameter on the wire. They will see the wire and get a gauge across the tube and measure that. It draws about 2.5 to 2.7 amps, approximately, about 2.7 amps of AC current when it is operating. It has a DC resistance of about 14.7 amps.
You measure resistance at 14.7 amps. That's a good one. I think you mean 14.7 ohms. 14.7 ohms on 110 volts ordinarily would be something like 8 amperes. The fact that you're measuring 2.5 to 3 amperes, 2.7 amperes, suggests that some amount of significant inductance is happening somewhere. I'm a little bit confused by that one because air as a inductive material has a mu of 1. It has no real ability to store magnetic energy. Normally when you get an arc across a switch, particularly on something like a relay or a transformer, it represents a stored magnetic energy that at the instant of disconnection, the magnetic field is collapsing. The rapidly collapsing coil magnetic field gives you a great big voltage buildup, and they call that the inductive kickback. The way many of us run into it for the very first time is that you'll take a power transformer and you want to measure the primary resistance. A naive person will take the two leads of the primary with their bare fingers, press it against the two leads of an ohmmeter on the times 1 ohm scale. And you'll watch the needle slowly climb toward, we'll say, 3 ohms from the infinity area as the magnetic field is charging the primary of the transformer. So far, so good. And then you decide that, okay, the test is over and you want to disconnect it. And as you disconnect that lead with your finger there, the inductive kickback will put, let me pick a number, 1,000 volts across those two leads. Your finger is on those two leads and you feel it. And you'll say, ouch, It's not dangerous, but it's damn uncomfortable. That's the inductive kickback. In your particular case, you're apparently storing enough magnetic field somewhere that you see an arc when you disconnect it. Interesting. I'm sure you could put a surge protecting device, a MOV, for instance. The MOVs that they put in these multi-tap devices that you're supposed to put computers into to make sure that they're giving you some surge protection. That would help. A more sophisticated approach would be a resistor capacitor network that acts
repeater. Time out.
A resistor capacitor network that acts like a damper, a energy absorber. You remember in the old days of Kettering ignition system, the automatic, the old-fashioned points and the spark coil that we used to have in our car. There was a very specific capacitor across those points for about two reasons. One, to limit the amount of ignition noise that got into the radio. And second of all, when that capacitor is properly sized, it limits the amount of inductive kickback of the coil and the sparking that takes place across your points, and therefore the points of the automobile working on that rotor would last longer. If you left out the capacitor, you'd wipe out those points in a very short period of time. So, I know that there is a combination of MOV, RC capacitor and resistor that you could put across the coil, which would aid in this kickback, therefore limit the sparking. The sparking itself, I presume, you're concerned that each time you operate the switch, you're with that spark depositing metallic particles from one side of the contacts to the other. They're becoming pitted, and that switch is only going to work a small number of times, maybe 300 times maximum before it'll give you a failure if you don't do something about it. That's what I think is going on here. Let me first find out your major motivation for wanting to eliminate the spark that occurs on the on-off switch, and how did you actually see it? Is it a open assembly? You heard the sparking? A couple more words there would help, Joe. WE2RYY, K2RYW on the TechNet.
He meant to say ohms instead of amps. You caught me on that one there, but I was talking fast. You can't see the arc, but you can hear the arc when the switch is open. You can actually hear the arc for a split second, so it is some appreciable size. And exactly like what you said, I like to preserve the length of preserve the time the switch operates, try to increase it as long as possible. I mean, I don't plan to use this thing every day, but anything I could do that help prolong the life of the switch would be an advantage. Now, the resistor-capacitor combination sounds like a good idea, and I do see that used on the power supplies I use on my GE repeater. They have those across several relay contacts for operating AC fan, also operating on the DC section, but there's two different sizes they use. Now, I happen to have a couple of capacitors that are fairly high voltage and some low ohmage resistors. They happen to use, on the AC contacts, and that thing, the fan is not drawing anywhere near the kind of current, but they use like a 0.01 Mylar 400 volt rating and a 10 ohm resistor, both in series across the contacts. Would you think something like that might be sufficient to do the job I'm looking to have it do?
Without a doubt, and this can, if you want to, become an interesting science project on what's called critical damping. But before I go there, the switch that you're operating is either a push-button switch or a toggle switch, I'm going to guess, and you'll clear that up with us. And you hear this loud sparking when you turn the switch off. I also recommend that you unplug the degaussing coil so that no power is going to it, but still operate that switch and double confirm that the sound that you heard is not just the switch itself in its normal operation making a loud clacking sound, that it really is a sparking inductive kickback. So you can confirm that pretty fast by operating it without it being plugged in, and then with it being plugged in, and compare the difference in the sound you hear when you turn it off. Next, you'd like to know what is the, as far as critical damping is concerned, there is an ideal resistor, an ideal capacitor, that will give you the most critical damping. And if you really wanted to really get it on the head and do the job just right, you want to know how much inductance that coil has. Measuring the inductance of the coil is relatively easy. In one case, you know the diameter, you know the number of turns, and by way of a formula you've got in the amateur radio handbook, you can calculate the number of microhenries it has. You can measure it by taking your 6.3-volt filament transformer. And the reason I chose a 6.3-volt filament transformer is because that lower voltage will allow you to run the coil continuously, whereas when you plug it into the 110-volt line, I guarantee you would not allow it to run for 60 solid seconds. I'll bet you the manufacturer told you, don't use it longer than this number of seconds, otherwise you might burn it up. So at a 6.3 volts with, I'm going to pick a number, a 1-ohm resistor in series with the filament winding, the 6.3 volt winding, by measuring the voltage drop across the 1-ohm resistor, and if you want to really do it scientifically, do it with an oscilloscope so that you trace a pattern across the screen, and you can actually measure the phase shift. So by measuring the voltage drop across the 1-ohm resistor, although in a way you've already done that, you've measured the amperes. Since you know it draws 2.7 amps, you know how many ohms it's got, and you know that the inductance plus that repeater,
timeout,
the inductance plus that resistance equals the overall impedance you experienced. And here's what I'm going to do a quick calculation for. You put 120 volts AC into it. You drew I'm going to call it 2.7 amps. 2.7 amps, 120 volts, means that the total impedance was 44.4 ohms. The 44.4 ohms consists of the 14.7 ohms of DC resistance that you measured, plus some amount of reactance. And how do you calculate overall impedance? It's the square root of the sum of the squares. In other words, 14.7 ohms squared plus some amount of inductive reactance squared, summed together, take the square root of that, the answer would come out 44.4 ohms. That's why you drew 2.7 amps on a 120 volt supply. And now, it's not very difficult to you with a little bit of algebra to find out how many ohms of inductive reactance plugged into that formula would give you the right answer. Once you know the number of ohms of the inductive reactance of your coil, once you know the resistance of the coil, there is a process by which you can now select the ideal capacitor and the ideal resistor that will give you critical damping. And that will give you the smallest amount of possible voltage during the inductive kickback when you turn off the switch. But before you go all the way down that road and do that science experiment, do the very simple experiment of turning the switch on and off, push button or toggle, with no AC power applied, and really, is there that much difference in the sound? W2RY1, KQRYW in the TechNet.
KC2, QIQ.
Glenn recognized. Joe first, and then Glenn. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, the coil is made by RCA. It's a fairly old coil. It's probably 20, 25 years old, maybe more than that. It looks pretty old in construction. Almost looks like it was homebrew. The switch is in series on the line cord. It's an old rocker switch, a small, simple rocker switch on one leg of the AC cord. That's how this thing is built. Actually, it doesn't even have a fuse in the damn thing, which really probably really should for safety purposes. I ran the thing up to about 30 seconds in time so far when I've used it, and in 30 seconds you can definitely feel the thing getting warm in your hand, so it doesn't take that long to heat the damn thing up. So that's what it is. But I did absolutely operate the switch with the thing not put in, and it makes a different type of sound. It's a perceivable sound. The perceivable arcing sound is only there when it's plugged into the wall.
Okay, you've answered all those questions. Glenn, what's your suggestion? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Good evening, everybody on the net. Something that a little bit of experience that I've had in the past, trying to design circuits that have active switches inside of explosive environments. And, of course, the first thing you have to do is you have to make sure that nothing is arcing, and if it is arcing, it's very, very well sealed. But the RCs, I can tell you right now, they're going to help you a little bit, but they're not going to be as effective as back-to-back diodes. If you have a switch across an AC circuit, size basically Zener diodes, or what they refer to as transorbs, they're basically back-to-back Zeners. And if you know what the peak inverse voltage is across the switch when the switch is open, be about 150% greater than the maximum PIV that you would expect on the switch when the switch is in the open position. And so basically, let's say if you have 100 volts there, make sure you have at least 150 volts of Zener. And you can have them back to back. This way, when you open and close that, the peak voltage across it will never go higher than 150 peak. It's a very, very nice thing. And the other thing, too, is you can get some heavy-duty ones, too, up to, like, 5-watt packages, and they'll absorb lots and lots of energy. Back to you, Dick, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I like your calculations. I like your methodology, but there's a little bit of a math error there, Glenn. The 120-volt line is a sine wave with 120 volts of RMS, equivalent heating characteristic. It hits 167 volts peak, so therefore you don't want to put 150-volt Zeners in there. I would put in a 200-volt Zener. So a 200-volt Zener back-to-back, 200-volt Zener, that's one beautiful approach. I think another kind of transorb is the MOV, metal oxide varistor type thing. And those things, it looks like a great big 0.2 microfarad disc ceramic capacitor with a plastic-like, a ceramic-like coating on the outside is what the things look like. Either of those or both of them should do the job very nicely. And that maybe is a brute force approach as opposed to the critical damping. So you got three choices there. An MOV, back-to-back, I would call it 200-volt Zener diodes, or an RC network. Back to you for any comments on all of the above, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW.
Dick, Radio Shack sells those MOVs. I've used them in 2EO.
And where have you used them, Rich? And what was your motivation? And tell me about Radio Shack MOVs. How many dollars? How are they rated? In his particular case, if they're rated in order to absorb a spike on the 110-volt line in order to protect your computer, that's one kind of a rating. Another kind of a rating would be to absorb a specific number of joules. See, 1/2 Li squared. If he knew the inductance in Henry, and he does know the current, 2.7 amperes of RMS current, and I'm going to pick a number, maybe that's 3.5 volts of peak current, because it's a sine wave, 1/2 Li squared means that 1/2 of the inductance times the peak current squared is the total number of joules he has in stored energy in that coil that comes rolling back out of that switch when the switch becomes an open circuit. So there's a specific number of joules that an MOV can absorb without it itself becoming damaged. So where were you using them, Rich, and how did you select the right size? N2EO, K2RYW.
Okay, Dick, I don't have the specs handy, but you can go on RadioShack.com. Any part they have there, you could bring it up and look at the specs. It was recommended that particular part number from Radio Shack, when you solid state the 516F2 Collins power supply, they recommend that MOV across the primary of the transformer.
KC2QIQ?
You've got it, Glenn.
Serious warning about MOVs. MOVs, unfortunately, are wearing out from the first time you hit them with a pulse. Even if they're supersized, they wear out. As a matter of fact, the problem is so severe that Underwriters Laboratories and most of the other governing bodies that are representing safety around the world have basically outlawed the use of MOVs in the front-end protection of filters, power supplies, and appliances, mainly because after a period of time, it's very, very possible that the MOV can explode and catch on fire, which has happened, you know, to many, many products. So now today, basically, either if you can't do it with a transorb, the only other suggestion is spacing and making sure that you have the right amount of the right size plates on the connections, so when they're open and closing. But in the case of what Joe is talking about, I certainly think his best answer would be back-to-back transorbs, you know, something, a solid-state device rated at least 150 times the peak voltage, you know, to solve the situation. But MOVs, real bad news, because especially if he's seeing a lot of energy there, unless the thing is the size of a hockey puck, it's probably not going to last that long. KC2QIQ.
QKEY.
Yeah, also 2, Bravo Delta. Okay, I heard Bravo Delta, and I heard Mel also. Let me go back to Glenn for a second now. Are you saying that the method of failure of an MOV, at least some of the times, instead of, let's say you had one that got a 200-volt rating, and as you start hitting it with more and more spikes, I think you're telling me the voltage at which it starts conducting comes down, and eventually it becomes a quasi-short circuit across the 110-volt line? Is that the mechanism of failure that makes them explode and catch on fire? Back to you, Glenn.
Absolutely. And that's the problem with the MOV, and that's why they're outlawed now, because what kind of happens is that the ones that last are the ones in environments where they're not needed, because they're never really seeing, because an MOV is a very soft device. It's not like a solid-state device where it clamps the voltage very quickly. It's very, very soft. But if you start banging it into the area where it's working, and you do it continuously, and how this came about was through surge testing. And, you know, people would apply, you know, level 2, level 3 surge testing on these things, and eventually you would see that with repetitive, continuous hitting of the MOVs, eventually they short out and, you know, go on fire and they explode and go really, really ugly. As I said, you know, where if you have a properly sized switch, it should last forever if it's sized properly.
Okay, good information. Mel, wait for the beep, and maybe we should at least once wait to make sure that anyone out of area wants to sign in. So let the machine thoroughly drop for a second or two, Mel. K2KEY with a delay, and after that we'll pick up John. K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is K2KY. First of all, that's the Delta that he's talking about. Oh, I've had that thing for many, many years, go way back when I was fooling around on the side with color TVs, the old color TVs, the originals, came through the 21-inch picture tube. they were always getting problems with becoming magnetized, and degaussing them was a common thing, so I must have used that degaussing coil hundreds of times. The one he described, it looks like a homebrew, but no, that's the way it was made, with the zip cord coming out of it and the whole thing taped around. It looks like, I could say, like a homebrew around, well, it was about 14 inches in diameter. Now, what they had on that originally, the thumb switch, they had a grease in there. This was originally, I mean, you know, the RCA bulletin that came through, a Zenith bulletin, one of them what came through. They had this green grease they used to sell that they used to pile into the switches. And it was some kind of, it used to absorb, I believe, the arc or whatever it was, a green-colored grease. And in fact, the Zenith used to use it either in their tuners after you cleaned up one of their gold video guard tuners. Used to smear this green grease on it. I don't remember what the heck the name of it was, but I can remember the grease quite well. I think, in fact, I have a tube of it. The next thing also was that when they started then, right after that, building in the degausses into the TV set. Let me let it drop. They built in the degaussing coil into the early color TV set. What they did, when you first turned the set on, they had, while the filters were warming up, you know, the set was warming up for the first 10, 15 seconds or whatever, it turned on the degaussing coil, and then it heated up this, this little, what the heck they call those things, the black thing, I remember, it was black in color. Sat there on the chassis, what the heck did they call that? I can't think of the name of it offhand, but it was a black thing, and as it heated up, after about 12 seconds, the degaussing coil essentially was actually disconnected. It had no relays or switches that were doing it. It was just that this device was a type of heat-sensitive coil. I can't think
of the Mr.
name that they used to call it, Dick, over.
So, Mr., they used a thermistor and a barista.
7s were in series, they had something called a bolo resistor, which again was a negative resistance. The set would come on slowly by that negative resistance device heating up, going to a smaller number of ohms, and eventually full filament voltage was applied to the tubes, as opposed to them coming on with a surge. So there were various devices like this. The more I'm listening to all of this, the more I'm liking the idea of the back-to-back Zener diodes. And with, let's see what John's got to say about all this. KC2, I think it is, Bravo Delta, K2RIW, you got it, John.
Good evening, Dick, K2RIW on the net from KD2BD. I ran through the numbers, and I come up with an inductance of the coil being 111 millihenries. K2RIW from KD2BD.
Very good. Okay, so you solved the equation for him. And now you're going to tell us what's the ideal R and C for a critical damping. And I didn't give you the formula for that. Be it known that John is one of the major creators of a beautiful program called SPLAT, S-P-L-A-T, which does propagation predictions and areas of coverage predictions in a number of broadcast centers and the FCC and a number of people are using this thing. John's going to tell us what's the website where you can spot it off. I guess it looks like I've got http://splat.ecok.edu is one of the places where you can enter the program, and apparently it's becoming very respected. John's going to give us a better way of getting into his program, which I think is FreeWAM. John's going to correct that for us too. And in the last email you mailed me, John, you told me about the fact that sometimes it calculates a curved path, and I wanted to give you a couple of questions about that. That worried me a little bit. KD2BD, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2RIW on the TechNet from KD2BD. I think what I meant there is that if you plot a point-to-point link and you look at the map that's generated, if you look at it very closely, that you'll see that the path is curved because it's being plotted on a Mercator projection map. And it's not a straight line on a Mercator projection map. It would look like a straight line on the globe, but not on a flat map. That website that you quoted is one that was put together by Dr. Bill Walker, W5GSE, which runs the Splat software that I created, and it has a web-based front end to it so that you don't need to have Splat running on your machine. You don't have to have the terrain data or any other functions that are required in the program, and you just need a web browser and an internet connection, and you register yourself with that website and put in the appropriate information, and then it will plot ridge area for you or some information on a point-to-point link. And if you really want to get going on the program and do all kinds of neat stuff, then you download the program and you put it on your own machine. But this is a Linux-based program, so you're going to need a Linux box to do this. K2RW and the TechNet from KD2BD.
And I had one of the introductory programs here. I can't seem to find that page right now, where it tells me the acronym, SPLAT, spherical. Tell us what SPLAT stands for, John.
It's something like signal propagation loss and terrain analysis. Originally, I named the program SPLAT only because I was doing line of sight path analysis, and when you do that you're doing that over a bumpy terrain, the pattern that looks like a splat on the windshield. So I gave it that name based on that, but then later on I came up with a suitable acronym, K2RW from KD2BD.
Okay, almost all radio paths are a great circle path, either long path or short path, but almost all radio paths are a great circle path. So therefore, on a perfect globe, it would be a straight line on the globe. And depending on the projection of your particular mapping system, in order to take a spherical object called Earth and lay it on a flat piece of paper, various techniques are forcing it onto the flat paper, which creates certain errors. So a truly straight path on a globe, when plotted on very many connecting sheets of, say, for instance, U.S. Geodetic Survey, U.S. Geologic Survey, you know, the the 7.5-minute series maps, the highest resolution survey maps you can buy, which give you contours of terrain height. On those maps, a very long path would look slightly curved. I presume it was spherical trigonometry required in order to calculate the intermediate lats and longs of the positions in between the source and the sink of a propagating path. It took spherical trigonometry to calculate those lats and longs so that you could go to the database to find out what was the height of the contour of the land in that area. Is that true, John? Go ahead.
I believe that's true. I know I relied pretty heavily on the Satellite Experimenter's Handbook from the AWRL, and they go into spherical trigonometry because they deal a lot with explaining how different mapping techniques and satellite tracking techniques work, and how in the old days the Oscar locator that was used for predicting satellite passes, how it worked, and how the spider web were created, and all that stuff. So yeah, that book goes into pretty good detail on how that path works, and they give you formulas and equations on how to calculate all those intermediate paths, the latitude, longitude of all those paths, all those points, I mean. K2RW from KB2BD.
Yeah, the reason I'm interested in that, I've seen a lot of people make error in this area. If, for instance, I knew the latin long of a starting position for a radio signal and the latin long for the ending position for a radio signal, the average person says, okay, I'll take the starting and ending latitude and I'll divide it into equal steps. I'll take the starting and ending longitude and I'll divide it into equal steps. And then I'll take those intermediate peak points by combining lats and longs. Logical sounding technique. As you get closer and closer to the North Pole, or as you just get away from the equator, that technique breaks down. Try that, for instance, on if you have any doubt. And also, the bearing distance, the bearing angle, what's the word I'm looking for now? Right ascension, declination. Oh, that's in astronomy. I've got to get back into the real terrestrial world. Azimuth. An azimuth setting from and to, in general, are not 180 degrees apart. In other words, if that guy that I want to talk to in Boston is exactly to the northeast of me at 45 degrees, you would assume I'd take 180 degrees, add it to it, and that he sends a signal back to me at 225 degrees. Absolutely not. And if you have any doubt about that, try it near the North Pole. In other words, make believe I'm 1 mile from the North Pole on the Canadian side, and the guy you want to talk to is 1 mile from the North Pole on the Russian side. He's in Siberia. Both of you aim your antennas dead north to talk to each other over that pole. Are those two bearings 180 degrees apart? No way in hell. So that just gives you a little bit of an example of how you can go wrong. The reason I'm asking this question, John, is that there was a real smart guy who had a doctorate in mathematics, who worked with me 10 years ago. He showed me the derivations of the spherical equations to do it correctly, spherical trigonometry equations that he came up with. He came up with a nice, simple set of equations, which gives you all the intermediate steps. And when it comes to satellite tracking, where you don't need that degree of accuracy, there may be one step more beyond that. I'm going to try to find that derivation he gave me and burn a copy of it for you, because there's some chance that there's a slight error there that could be improved if you want to. Because satellite tracking, intermediate position accuracy, and
repeater timeout,
and terrestrial path plotting are two very different degrees of accuracy required. Because there could be a real high point, so to speak, between a particular path. And that if you miss by a fraction of a mile, you'll think there's not a blockage when there really is, or vice versa. Now, let's go back to Joe's original question. Do you have any further questions, Joe, even though we got way off to one side here, on what we think is required? I think back-to-back Zener diodes are going to give you the best solution. When you try that, by taking a pair of back-to-back Zeners at, let's say, 200 volts, and to try and see if you hear the same amount of clacking sound. I think you will not. You're going to come back to us next week, or maybe even, you're such a fast guy, you may even do it in an hour. He just goes to his junk box, and he goes to the right drawer where the Zener's voltages are, and he chooses the ones that are between 190 and 210 volts. W2RYY, I'm having some fun with you, Joe. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I know, I know. Okay, well, I don't have to have those in stock. I have 130-volt RMS MOVs, and I got a couple of those laying around because I put those in some power supplies. And now that glove oil or something about these things blowing up after a while, it makes me a little concerned about that. But what am I going to do? I already put them in a couple of spots for protection purposes. I don't have any other questions as far as that. If you think the transwarps will do it, I'll go get some of those. I have another question related to simply photocells. About what do you think currently is the output of a, say, a photocell array that's approximately a square meter, 1 meter by 1 meter? What do you think you're going to be able to get out of total wattage for that type of assembly nowadays?
I don't know enough about the commercially available ones that I can give you an answer. I can tell you this, though. At high noon, with a flat sheet of something aimed directly normal to the sun is giving you a little bit less than 1,200 watts per square meter on a really clear day. So the raw power input to the solar cell is 1,200 watts per square meter. That's what the sun is giving you. Assuming that your particular photocells, your photovoltaics, I'm going to pick a number out of the air, are working at 8% efficiency, you can measure, you can multiply 0.08 times the 1,200 watts and know immediately how many watts your photocells should be able to give you. That's one approach. The right approach, of course, is to go to the data sheet of that particular manufacturer and put in a little bit of fudge factor, because he's probably telling you with the irradiance you get in downtown Phoenix, Arizona on a hot, sunny day, he's telling you how much power you're going to get out of it. On Long Island, the sky is never quite that clear. One of the real eye-opening experiments I did once is to put an ohmmeter, put a specific voltmeter and a specific load on a set of photocells on a sunny day in the summertime in my backyard. And I just sat there and watched it. And I watched the needle moving around all kinds of crazy ways. I did not see any clouds. This was a nice, pure blue sky day, I thought. Maybe a tiny bit of overcast. But there were things up there in the sky that the eye doesn't necessarily see. And I think it's the ultraviolet energy coming from the sun that does an awful lot of the work with the photovoltaics. So those ultraviolet shielding clouds that my eye didn't see were waving in and out between the sun and my particular backyard, and I was watching that needle move around. It probably only moved 15 or 20%, but it did move a significant amount per, let's say, 10 or 20 minute period of time. So what we get here and what you get in Arizona are going to be very different. Back to you, Joe, and drag your feet in case anyone else has got some more photovoltaic information. I bet you Glenn does. W2RYY with some delay, K2RYW.
KC2QAQ.
AZ. What did I tell you? Glenn's got it. And then Mr. AZ will go after that. Glenn first, go ahead.
Yeah, the quick and simple answer is in about a square meter in the Long Island area, figure about 250 watts. In real direct sunlight, real powerful, maybe 400, but average for about 250 watts, and I think you're in the ballpark. KC2QIQ.
By the way, since Glenn, because John calculated 111 millihenry, 0.11 henry, 0.111 henry, 1/2 Li squared with your 2.7 amperes, means that you're storing 0.4 joule. In other words, the stored energy, if you happen to open up the switch at the worst case instant, when the current is hitting the maximum peak, the amount of stored energy that's going to come roaring back and it's going to be capable of damaging your switch contacts is 0.4 joule. A joule is a watt second. In other words, 1 watt flowing into a resistor for 1 whole second is a total amount of energy input to the resistor of 1 joule. 0.4 joule tells you exactly how many watt seconds you have to absorb. There was another person, something like AZ, give me that full call because you guys doubled a little bit, your name, and then your comment on all of the above. KQRIW, my name is Dick.